good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 585 of Unwelcome Guests, Institutionalizing Wage Slavery. I'm Robin Upton. Following on from last week's wondering about whether wage slaves of the 21st century would look back and wonder why it took them so long to object to that institution, this week we've got a range of topics centered around wage slavery. In our second hour, we're going to hear some more of David Graeber. We have a video parable called Freetopia. In our first hour, we'll conclude with a recording of my presentation on the history of plutocracy to the Chaos Computer Conference in Berlin. But first, courtesy of archive.org, this is a reading of Chapter 2 of Wendell Berry's The Unsettling of America.
Chapter 2. The Ecological Crisis as a Crisis of Character. Wanting good government in their states, they first established order in their own families. Wanting order in the home, they first disciplined themselves. Confucius, The Great Digest. In July of 1975, it was revealed by William Rood in the Los Angeles Times that some of our largest and most respected conservation organizations own stock in the very corporations and industries that have been notorious for their destructiveness and for their indifference to the concerns of conservationists. The Sierra Club, for example, had owned stocks and bonds in Exxon, General Motors, Tenneco Steel Companies, having the worst pollution records in the industry, Public Service Company of Colorado, strip mining firms with 53 leases covering nearly 180,000 acres, and pulp mill operators cited by environmentalists for their poor water pollution controls. These investments proved deeply embarrassing once they were made public, but the club's officers responded as quickly as possible by making appropriate changes in its investment policy. And so, if it were only a question of policy, these investments could easily be forgotten, dismissed as aberrations of the sort that inevitably turn up now and again in the workings of organizations. The difficulty is that, although the investments were absurd, they were not aberrant. They were perfectly representative of the modern character. These conservation groups were behaving with a very ordinary consistency. They were only doing as organizations what many of their members were and are doing as individuals. They were making convenience of enterprises that they knew to be morally and even practically indefensible. We are dealing, then, with an absurdity that is not a quirk or an accident, but is fundamental to our character as people. The split between what we think and what we do is profound. It is not just possible, it is altogether to be expected, that our society would produce conservationists who invest in strip mining companies, just as it must inevitably produce asthmatic executives whose industries pollute the air, and vice presidents of pesticide corporations whose children are dying of cancer. And these people will tell you that this is the way of the real world. They will pride themselves on their sacrifices for our standard of living. They will call themselves practical men and hard-headed realists, and they will have their justifications in abundance from intellectuals, college professors, clergymen, politicians. The viciousness of a mentality that can look complacently upon disease as part of the cost would be obvious to any child, but this is the realism of millions of modern adults. There is no use pretending that the contradiction between what we think or say and what we do is a limited phenomenon. There's no group of extra intelligent or extra concerned or extra virtuous that is exempt. I cannot think of any American whom I know or have heard of who is not contributing in some way to destruction. The reason is simple. To live undestructively in an economy that is overwhelmingly destructive would require of any one of us, or of any small group of us, a great deal more work than we have yet been able to do. How could we divorce ourselves completely and yet responsibly from the technologies and powers that are destroying our planet? The answer is not yet thinkable, and it will not be thinkable for some time, even though there are now groups and families and persons everywhere in the country who have begun the labor of thinking it. And so we are by no means divided, or readily divisible, into environmental saints and sinners. But there are legitimate distinctions that need to be made. These are distinctions of degree and of consciousness. Some people are less destructive than others, and some are more conscious of their destructiveness than others. For some, their involvement in pollution, soil depletion, strip mining, deforestation, industrial and commercial waste is simply a practical compromise, a necessary reality, the price of modern comfort and convenience. For others, this list of involvements is an agenda for thought and work that will produce remedies. People who thus set their lives against destruction have necessarily confronted in themselves the absurdity that they have recognized in their society. They have first observed the tendency of modern organizations to perform in opposition to their stated purposes. They've seen governments that exploit and oppress the people they are sworn to serve and protect, medical procedures that produce ill health, schools that preserve ignorance, methods of transportation that, as Ivan Illich says, have created more distances than they bridge. And they've seen that these public absurdities are, and can be, no more than the aggregate result of private absurdities. The corruption of community has its source in the corruption of character. This realization has become the typical moral crisis of our time. Once our personal connection to what is wrong becomes clear, then we have to choose. We can go on as before, recognizing our dishonesty and living with it the best we can, or we can begin the effort to change the way we think and live. The disease of the modern character is specialization. Looked at from the standpoint of the social system, the aim of specialization may seem desirable enough. The aim is to see that the responsibilities of government, law, medicine, engineering, agriculture, education, etc., are given into the hands of the most skilled, best prepared people. The difficulties do not appear until we look at specialization from the opposite standpoint, that of individual persons. We then begin to see the grotesquerie, indeed the impossibility, of an idea of community wholeness that divorces itself from any idea of personal wholeness. The first and best known hazard of the specialist system is that it produces specialists, people who are elaborately and expensively trained to do one thing. We get into absurdity very quickly here. There are, for instance, educators who have nothing to teach, communicators who have nothing to say, medical doctors skilled at expensive cures for diseases that they have no skill and no interest in preventing. More common and more damaging are the investors, manufacturers, and salesmen of devices who have no concern for the possible effects of those devices. Specialization is thus seen to be a way of institutionalizing, justifying, and paying highly for a calamitous disintegration and scattering out of the various functions of character, workmanship, care, conscience, responsibility. Even worse, a system of specialization requires the abdication to specialists of various competences and responsibilities that were once personal and universal. Thus, the average, one is tempted to say the ideal, American citizen, now consigns the problem of food production to agriculturalists and agribusinessmen, the problem of health to doctors and sanitation experts, the problem of education to school teachers and educators, the problems of conservation to conservationists, and so on. This supposedly fortunate citizen is therefore left with only two concerns: making money and entertaining himself. He earns money typically as a specialist, working an 8-hour day at a job for the quality or consequences of which somebody else, or perhaps more typically nobody else, will be responsible. And not surprisingly, since he can do so little else for himself, he's even unable to entertain himself, for there exists an enormous industry of exorbitantly expensive specialists whose purpose is to entertain him. The beneficiary of this regime of specialists ought to be the happiest of mortals, or so we are expected to believe. All of his vital concerns are in the hands of certified experts. He is a certified expert himself, and such he earns more money in a year than all his great-grandparents put together. But since at his job he has nothing to do with mow his lawn with a sit-down lawnmower or watch other certified experts on television. At supper time he may eat a tray of ready-prepared food, which he and his wife, also a certified expert, procure at the cost only of money, transportation, and the pushing of a button. For a few minutes, between supper and sleep, he may catch a glimpse of his children, who since breakfast have been in the care of education experts, basketball or marching band experts, or perhaps legal experts. The fact is, however, that this is probably the most unhappy average citizen in the history of the world. He has not the power to provide himself with anything but money, and his money is inflating like a balloon and drifting away, subject to historical circumstances and the power of other people. From morning to night, he does not touch anything that he has produced himself, in which he can take pride. For all his leisure and recreation, he feels bad, he looks bad, he is overweight, his health is poor. His air, water, and food are all known to contain poisons. There's a fair chance that he will die of suffocation. He suspects that his love life is not as fulfilling as other people's. He wishes that he had been born sooner or later. He does not know why his children are the way they are. He does not understand what they say. He does not care much and does not know why he does not care. He does not know what his wife wants or what he wants. Certain advertisements and pictures in magazines make him suspect that he is basically unattractive. He feels that all his possessions are under threat of pillage. He does not know what he would do if he lost his job, if the economy failed, if the utility companies failed, if the police went on strike, if the truckers went on strike, if his wife left him, if his children ran away, if he should be found to be incurably ill. And for these anxieties, of course, he consults certified experts, who in turn consult certified experts about their anxieties. It is rarely considered that this average citizen is anxious because he ought to be, because he still has some gumption that he has not yet given up in deference to the experts. He ought to be anxious because he is helpless, that he is dependent upon so many specialists, the beneficiary of so much expert help, can only mean that he is a captive, a potential victim. If he lives by the competence of so many other people, then he lives also by their indulgence. His own will and his own reasons to live are made subordinate to the mere tolerance of everybody else. He has one chance to live what he conceives to be his life, his own small specialty within a delicate, tense, everywhere strained system of specialties. From a public point of view, the specialist system is a failure because, though everything is done by an expert, very little is done well. Our typical industrial or professional product is both ingenious and shoddy. The specialist system fails from a personal point of view because a person who can do only one thing can do virtually nothing for himself. In living in the world by his own will and skill, the stupidest peasant or tribesman is more competent than the most intelligent worker or technician or intellectual in a society of specialists. What happens under the rule of specialization is that, though society becomes more and more intricate, it has less and less structure. It becomes more and more organized, but less and less orderly. The community disintegrates because it loses the necessary understandings, forms, and enactments of the relations among materials and processes, principles and actions, ideals and realities, past and present and future, men and women, body and spirit, city and country, civilization and wilderness, growth and decay, life and death, just as the individual character loses the sense of a responsible involvement in these relations. No longer does human life rise from the earth like a pyramid, broadly, and considerately founded upon its sources. Now it scatters itself out in a reckless horizontal sprawl, like a disorderly city whose suburbs and pavements destroy the fields. The concept of country, homeland, dwelling place, becomes simplified as the environment, that is, what surrounds us. Once we see our place, our part of the world, as surrounding us, we've already made a profound division between it and ourselves. We've given up the understanding, dropped it out of our language and so out of our thought, that we and our country create one another, depend on one another, are literally part of one another, that our land passes in and out of our bodies, just as our bodies pass in and out of our land, that as we and our land are part of one another, so all who are living as neighbors here, human and plant and animal, are part of one another, and so cannot possibly flourish alone. That, therefore, our culture must be our response to our place. Our culture and our place are images of each other and inseparable from each other, and so neither can be better than the other. Because, by definition, they lack any sense of mutuality or wholeness, our specializations subsist on conflict with one another. The rule is never to cooperate, but rather to follow one's own interest as far as possible. Checks and balances are all applied externally, by opposition, never by self-restraint. Labor, management, the military, the government, etc., never forbear until their excesses arouse enough opposition to force them to do so. The good of the whole of creation, the world and all its creatures together, is never a consideration because it is never thought of. Our culture now simply lacks the means for thinking of it. It is for this reason that none of our basic problems is ever solved. Indeed, it is for this reason that our basic problems are getting worse. The specialists are profiting too well from the symptoms, evidently, to be concerned about cures. Just as the myth of imminent cure, by some breakthrough of science or technology, is so lucrative and all-justifying as to foreclose any possibility of an interest in prevention. The problems thus become the stock in trade of specialists. The so-called professions survive by endlessly processing and talking about problems that they have neither the will nor the competence to solve. The doctor who is interested in disease but not in health is clearly in the same category with the conservationist who invests in the destruction of what he otherwise intends to preserve. They both have the comfort of job security, but at the cost of ultimate futility. One of the most troubling characteristics of the specialist mentality is its use of money as a kind of proxy, its willingness to transmute the powers and functions of life into money. Time is money is one of its axioms, and the source of many evils, among them, the waste of both time and money. Akin to the idea that time is money is the concept less spoken, but as commonly assumed, that we may be adequately represented by money. The giving of money has thus become our characteristic virtue. But to give is not to do. The money is given in lieu of action, thought, care, time. And it is no remedy for the fragmentation of character and consciousness that is the consequence of specialization. At the simplest, most practical level, it would be difficult for most of us to give enough in donations to good causes to compensate for, much less remedy, the damage done by the money that is taken from us and used destructively by various agencies of the government and by the corporations that hold us in captive dependence on their products. More important, if we could give enough to overbalance the official and corporate misuse of our money, we would still not solve the problem. The willingness to be represented by money involves a submission to the modern divisions of character and community. The remedy safeguards the disease. This has become, to some extent at least, an argument against institutional solutions. Such solutions necessarily fail to solve the problems to which they are addressed because, by definition, they cannot consider the real causes. The only real, practical, hope-giving way to remedy the fragmentation that is the disease of the modern spirit is a small and humble way, a way that a government or agency or organization or institution will never think of, though a person may think of it. One must begin in one's own life the private solutions that can only, in turn, become public solutions. If, for instance, one is aware of the abuses and extortions to which one is subjected as a modern consumer, then one may join in an organization of consumers to lobby for consumer protection legislation. But in joining a consumer organization, one defines oneself as a consumer merely, and a mere consumer is by definition a dependent, at the mercy of the manufacturer and the salesman. If the organization secures the desired legislation, then the consumer becomes the dependent not only of the manufacturer and salesman, but of the agency that enforces the law, and is at its mercy as well. The law enacted may be a good one, and the enforcers all honest and effective. Even so, the consumer will understand that one result of his effort has been to increase the number of people of whom he must beware. The consumer may proceed to organization and even to legislation by considering only his rights. And most of the recent talk about consumer protection has had to do with the consumer's rights. Very little indeed has been said about the consumer's responsibilities. It may be that whereas one's rights may be advocated and even served by an organization, one's responsibilities cannot. It may be that when one hands one's responsibilities to an organization, one becomes, by that divestiture, irresponsible. It may be that the responsibility is intransigently a personal matter, that a responsibility can be fulfilled or failed, but cannot be got rid of. If a consumer begins to think and act in consideration of his responsibilities, then he vastly increases his capacities as a person. And he begins to be effective in a different way, a way that is smaller, perhaps, and certainly less dramatic, but sounder, and able sooner or later to assume the force of example. A responsible consumer would be a critical consumer, would refuse to purchase the less good, and he would be a moderate consumer. He would know his needs and would not purchase what he did not need. He would sort among his needs and study to reduce them. These things, of course, have been often said, though in our time they have not been said very loudly and have not been much heeded. In our time, the rule among consumers has been to spend money recklessly. People whose governing habit is the relinquishment of power, competence, and responsibility, and whose characteristic suffering is the anxiety of futility, make excellent spenders. They are the ideal consumers. By inducing in them little panics of boredom, powerlessness, sexual failure, mortality, paranoia, they can be made to buy, or vote for, virtually anything that is attractively packaged. The advertising industry is founded upon this principle. What has not been often said, because it did not need to be said until fairly recent times, is that the responsible consumer must also be in some way a producer. Out of his own resources and skills, he must be equal to some of his own needs. The household that prepares its own meals in its own kitchen with some intelligent regard for nutritional value, and thus depends on the grocer only for selected raw materials, exercises an influence on the food industry that reaches from the store all the way back to the seedsman. The household that produces some or all of its own food will have a proportionately greater influence. The household that can provide some of its own pleasures will not be helplessly dependent on the entertainment industry, will influence it by not being helplessly dependent on it, and will not support it thoughtlessly, out of boredom. The responsible consumer thus escapes the limits of his own dissatisfaction. He can choose and exert the influence of his choosing because he has given himself choices. He is not confined to the negativity of his complaint. He influences the market by his freedom. This is no specialized act, but an act that is substantial and complex, both practically and morally. By making himself responsibly free, a person changes both his life and his surroundings. It is possible, then, to perceive a critical difference between responsible consumers and consumers who are merely organized. The responsible consumer slips out of the consumer category altogether. He is a responsible consumer incidentally, almost inadvertently. He is a responsible consumer because he lives a responsible life. The same distinction is to be perceived between organized conservationists and responsible conservationists. A responsible consumer is, of course, a responsible conservationist. The conservationists who are merely organized function as specialists who have lost sight of basic connections. Conservation organizations hold stock in exploitative industries because they have no clear perception of, and therefore fail to be responsible for, the connections between what they say and what they do, what they desire, and how they live. The Sierra Club, for instance, defines itself by a slogan which it prints on the flaps of its envelopes. Its aim, according to the slogan, is to explore, enjoy, and protect the nation's scenic resources. To some extent, the club's current concerns and attitudes belie this slogan. There is also a sense in which the slogan defines the limits of organized conservation, some that have been self-imposed, others that are implicit in the nature of organization. The key word in the slogan is scenic. As used here, the word is a fossil. It is left over from a time when our comforts and luxuries were accepted simply as the rewards of progress to an ingenious, forward-looking people, when no threat was perceived in urbanization and industrialization, and when conservation was therefore an activity oriented toward vacations. It was good to get out of the city for a few weeks, or weekends a year, and there was understandable concern that there should remain pleasant places to go. Some of the more adventurous vacationers were even aware of places of unique beauty that would be defaced if they were not set aside and protected. These people were effective in their way and within their limits, and they started the era of wilderness conservation. The results will give us abundant reasons for gratitude, as long as we have sense enough to preserve them. But wilderness conservation did little to prepare us either to understand or to oppose the general mayhem of the all-outdoors that the Industrial Revolution has finally imposed upon us. Wilderness conservation, we can now see, is specialized conservation. Its specialization is memorialized in the Sierra Club slogan, in the word scenic. A scene is a place as seen by a viewer. It is a view. The appreciator of a place perceived as scenic is merely its observer, by implication both different and distant or detached from it. The connoisseur of the scenic has thus placed strict limitations both upon the sort of place he is interested in and upon his relation to it. But even if the slogan were made to read, "To explore, enjoy, and protect the nation's resources," the most critical concern would still be left out. For while conservationists are exploring, enjoying, and protecting the nation's resources, they're also using them. They are drawing their lives from the nation's resources, scenic and unscenic. If the resolve to explore, enjoy, and protect does not create a moral energy that will define and enforce responsible use, then organized conservation will prove ultimately futile. And this, again, will be a failure of character. Although responsible use may be defined, advocated, and to some extent required by organizations, it cannot be implemented or enacted by them. It cannot be effectively enforced by them. The use of the world is finally a personal matter, and the world can be preserved in health only by the forbearance and care of a multitude of persons. That is, the possibility of the world's health will have to be defined in the characters of persons as clearly and as urgently as the possibility of personal success is now defined. Organizations may promote this sort of forbearance and care, but they cannot provide it.
Well, I think perhaps the main reason why organizations, and also to a certain extent individuals, cannot be coherent is they're attributing value to money, which is ultimately worthless. Worse than that, it is a tool of empire. That is the case that I attempted to make in my History of Plutocracy presentation. Before we hear that, let's have a few minutes. This is a short video on fiat money, which is available, like my video presentation, from this show's website, unwelcomeguest.net/585.
Since 1971, when President Nixon took the United States off what was left of the gold standard, the world has operated under a system of money called fiat. The dollar, the pound, the euro are all government fiat currencies. Fiat is a Latin word meaning let it be so. It is the law that this government currency be money. Indeed, without that legal enforcement, and the fact that we must pay taxes in this money, that dollar bill or that computer digit that represents a dollar would be pretty much meaningless. Only the government has the power to issue fiat money, but banks can create it through lending. If somebody wants to borrow $10, a bank can create it from nowhere and lend it. It can then charge interest. Banks also create money by lending against an asset, such as a house. They're given the deeds to the house, and they create the money, out of nowhere, and lend it. At interest, of course. Over the last 40 years, since this fiat system of money became the global norm, the supply of money has grown exponentially. In fact, we've seen the greatest growth in the supply of money in history. But who benefits? Of course, those that have the power to issue money, governments and banks. They haven't had to do anything productive, they just create money. Then those companies and individuals that get this money early. They can spend it before the prices of the things they want to buy have risen to reflect the new money in circulation. In other words, they get services, products, assets cheap. But prices soon rise. So holders of assets such as shares or houses will then see gains without there necessarily being any improvements to the company or house in question. Often, this can lead to speculative bubbles. Who gets this money early? However money is created, be it through lending, fractional reserve banking, financial bailouts, or old-fashioned money printing, banks are always at or near the top of the money-issuing pyramid. Next come corporations who borrow large sums, those on lucrative government contracts for new ventures, particularly overseas, banks' associate companies and partners, those that borrow early and at low rates, and the bank's senior employees. They all quickly get their share of the pie. In some cases, this will come in the form of bonuses. But what about those at the bottom of the pyramid? Those on fixed wages or incomes, those who live in remote areas, or those with savings? By the time this newly created money has filtered down to them, the prices of the things they want to buy have increased. Their savings buy them less, however, and their wages remain largely unchanged. In some cases, they have to take on debt just to be able to afford the things they were previously able to buy, which means they have to go back to the banks. In reality, this process of creating money only redistributes wealth from the bottom to the top of the pyramid, and thus that ever-increasing gulf between rich and poor gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
And that video was a trailer for a forthcoming film available from 4horsemanfilm.com. It makes the very simple point that the money system is not, as is sometimes presented, a neutral factor on society, but does in fact, by design, move resources from the poorest to the richest members. And that can hardly be a surprise, since that is more or less how money systems have worked for a long time. Here's a recording of the presentation I gave to the 28th Chaos Computer Congress in Berlin a couple of weeks back, which I'm pleased to say has received several thousand views on YouTube and about 50 comments so far. If you have the internet, you may wish to go to YouTube and watch it, or download it from our website, or you could download the slides from altruists.org/AE901.
Thank you. I'm speaking on a brief history of plutocracy. Now, that first word, plutocracy, means rule by the rich. That's something that I'm glad to say has become more in focus, thanks to Occupy. So, this is a very general talk, I've got 20,000 years of world history to put into 20 slides. So I'm focusing especially on Europe, because that's quite important in development of plutocracy. And this is the public story of money that, if you've studied economics, you've heard. I mean, I didn't study economics much, as little as I could help. I don't think I could have made this talk if I had been told this is how economics is. So, if you don't know economics, that's not a hindrance. That might even be a help to understand this. Money is a medium of exchange, store of value, measure of productivity. It's always taught as like, okay, this is economics and that's politics and that's something separate and law. But I'm here to suggest that perhaps there's a private story of money, that it's means of extracting tribute. It's a means whereby a small number of people who run the show get all the other suckers to work for them. It's unsafe store of value. If you've worked, you think, okay, if I worked 8 hours a day, I could get more than if I worked 4 hours a day. Yeah, probably true. What about somebody who earns 50 times as much as you? He's not working 400 hours a day. He's working for the right people. And it's certainly not independent of the legal and political systems. And I'm here to try to get rid of some of the misinformation. So we're going right back to when people were hunter-gatherers. Now, these colors are constant through this presentation. So green is food. This is the order that they appear. People are first bothered with food, and then there's violence, black, labor, orders, and money. And these are kind of a pair that go together. If somebody's giving you orders, in modern day, they're probably also giving you money to make sure that you follow the orders. So people originally effectively know social classes. Everybody's main focus is, okay, how do we get food? And then they all share the food that they've got. So that is the story for a very long time. There's a limit to how large these kind of family-type tribes get. When they get beyond a certain number, they tend to split, and then you have another tribe that runs around, and we'll get onto that later. But that's the first social differentiation. When you're having more and more of these tribes in a limited area, not always, but sometimes things get a bit violent. People say, look, we were here first. This food belongs to us. Clear off. So the hunters, probably the men, became warriors. And okay, they did a bit of food, but they got more and more specialized to defend against the guys next door. And still, for most of the history, people are basically farmers. So how does this change? This changes with agriculture. Agriculture is a big thing because, okay, now people can grow food, and that is very important for possessions. If you're a hunter-gatherer, your property is basically what you can carry around. If you're doing agriculture, then you can live in the same place. So you can have a house. That's nice. So a few people, call them artisans. They're making houses. They're maybe making weapons for the warriors, making chicken runs, whatever they're making. So we have a class of laborers. So still, the farmers, they're feeding everybody. The laborers, they're providing goods for everybody. And the warriors, hunters, they are defending against the guys next door. So this is about 10,000 BC, more or less. So the next great innovation occurs, 6 months later, 9,999, then when the harvest comes, the old ethic of the hunter-gatherers, hey, lots of food, great, let's have a party. And you clear the place out of food and then you go somewhere else. Well, you can't do that if you're cultivating the land. You get a bumper harvest, lots of food, that's great. Some of the guys are thinking, hey, no, I think we better keep this because it might be a few months until we get some more food here. So you need a new ethic. And okay, that's our first rulers. We've got rules about when you can eat and when you can't eat. So you can eat if you're busy planting and planning ahead. Now these are not distant rulers on high. This is the most respected people and probably the elder men saying things like, okay, yeah, let's plan, let's plant this. And then we've got orders. Now, they're giving orders to these guys. If they're the older men, they're not physically going to be stopping everybody from eating. But you have a granary, maybe in the city, because your cities become possible because of increased population. Then you have maybe a couple of guards with some spears outside the granary. And this notice what's happening here. They are now ready to do violence to the farmers or to the artisans because they're following these rules. So this allows the population size to increase. Now, I said about the limit to group size. This is, okay, I put 150. That is Dunbar's number. He was an anthropologist who studied primates in Africa, looked at chimpanzees and gorillas and their social groupings, and said, okay, well, Homo sapiens, they have a bigger brain. They can remember more names and faces. And if you've got a few friends, sure, you don't have trouble to remember them. And remember, if somebody owes you one, you're not going to forget that. If you've got half a dozen friends, if you've got 150 friends, it gets harder. If you've got 500 friends, then you're losing the Übersicht. You're losing the view. Okay, who is the guy who's cheating me? Who's the guy who I have to pay back for last time? So what do you do? Because they had large populations together, they came up with a new technology, the local currency. That's called a human economy here. Now, this is not actually money as such. Don't think they invented money. Money was shells or beads or feathers. This was typically something that you would put on your person to make you more beautiful, more respectable. And it was standardized in a community. But it is a very important step in the foundation of plutocracy, because now we have a physical object and somebody's got a lot of them. They are a wealthy person. Maybe they're just wearing lots of feathers on their head, but this is something that you can say, okay, I have a lot of this and he doesn't, so he's a poor person, I'm a rich person. These guys are not in charge, this isn't a plutocracy yet, but that's a vital step. So the next step is, these are the same groups as we had before. I've changed this, I put a crown on the top of the ruler, because quite often they put a crown, they used to cover themselves with gold as a kind of a hint to how you should treat them. And they said, okay, we're going to invent a better technology, because if you have the Roman Empire, you can't run that with beads and feathers and shells, and that was all specific to a small community. If you've got an empire, you better have a large-scale community, and in Europe, the one that they hit upon was this system of metal discs that maybe you're familiar with. They said to the goldsmiths, I want you to make all these gold discs and make sure that you stamp my face on so everybody knows whose empire this is, in case there's any dispute. So the goldsmiths would provide money to the king, he give that to the soldiers. Now everybody wants those discs because it's important for taxes. The king says, okay, the rules is you have to give me so and so many discs in the occupied lands. And everybody wants to help feed these armies. This is essential to maintaining the armies. So now you can have standardized trade and travel. This is how the empires were forged. And the next step, I'm zapping quite fast into known history here, 1694, very important date in the development of plutocracy, because this is the first successful central bank. There was one before that wasn't very successful. This one was. And this was because this is basically thought up by the bankers. The king was having trouble collecting new loans from the nobles, the rich people. He had been a bit slack on repaying them. So they're thinking, well, maybe we don't want to lend to the king because we might need it back. But the bankers came up with a brilliant suggestion, or brilliant from their point of view, the legalization of the fractional reserve. Now, I should explain what the fractional reserve is. The goldsmiths would take your gold and give you a little piece of paper and say that this was could be exchanged for the gold. So they are issuing, this is the origins of paper money in Europe, and the fractional reserve came about because they figured out that they could issue this paper, and then it would work like gold in the marketplace. Somebody would not actually come and cash the gold all the time, they would just carry the paper around because it was easier. Then they thought, okay, so what about if we made some more paper without having any gold? That could be good because they can lend this out and the interest is legal at this stage. So this is what a lot of bankers did. I mean, it's basically fraud. If you said this paper is as good as gold and you can swap it anytime you like, well, if you're issuing more paper than you've got gold, you can get into trouble like that. But these guys said, okay, King, how about we'll make a thing called the Bank of England. It's a private company. It'll have shares and so on. And it will have a monopoly over issuing of money in England. So that only our bits of paper will be special. And you will say that they are acceptable as taxes. That's key because then everybody wants them. And even the people who don't pay taxes, they know that a lot of people need them. So it's like, okay, I'll take this. So that's what the bankers did. What did they get out of it? Well, They did put in some gold. There was supposed to be a limit on the amount of paper that they could make, maybe 10 times the amount of gold that they had. That's the fraction, and they kept a proportion of it in reserve. But they can basically create as much money as they like. And then they say, okay, to the king, what do you get out of it? Well, anytime you need money, come to us. We'll lend it to you at 8%, I think it was. So this is the origin of the national debt. The national debt is not owed from one country to the next. It's owed by the rulers to the guys who are running the central bank. So this was never actually paid back. It's still not paid back. And then the bankers thought, okay, we came up with that scheme, and he okayed it. I mean, you know, he's the king. You can't argue with the king. He says, hey, you're the bankers. I'm tired of you. I'm going to repossess you. And okay, we'll cut your heads off as well. He's the king. He's got the army on his side. How do you go against that? But there's some kind of contradiction here, because they are providing him with money. So shouldn't they be actually setting the terms? Well, that's what they thought. How come he gets to order us around because we're the guys with the money? This should work another way. And they managed to figure out how to do it because they organized internationally. Inside of one country, that you can't argue with the king. What is the king afraid of? He's afraid of guys coming with and rolling him over because they've got more guns than him. So this is the most important step that was, okay, hundreds of years ago, but it has great implications today. Because the king was really at some point no longer in charge. They were in charge because of their international organization. So how did that actually work? Well, it's been called the Rothschild formula. Because there was a banker in the 18th century, Meyer Amschel Rothschild. He was quite wealthy, and he had five sons. He said, okay, you go to England, you to France, you to Italy, you to Austria. You can stay here. When I'm gone, you can run it in Germany. And there was five bankers in this family, and each one of them became very wealthy. The Bank of England central bank franchise model became standard throughout Europe. And that puts us in a situation where, okay, the nations are busy fighting each other. And how do they fight each other with money? They borrow armies. They borrow it, maybe from somebody in the country, but also from foreign bankers. So there's basically one group of bankers who control who gets to borrow money from them and who doesn't. So they're, of course, closely connected to the arms dealers. You don't actually fight a war with money, but they manage that. But there's one group. And they said, okay, if you want to borrow money from me, of course, you're going to have to sign about when you're going to pay it back. But you're also going to have to agree that if you actually defeat this king that you're fighting, you're going to make sure that those loans get paid back as well. Because I'm going to lose out otherwise. I'm not going to fund you so that you can beat him if I don't get paid back. So whoever actually won these wars, because of this condition, well, the bankers got to... I mean, it happens nowadays that there's wars going on. Bankers can lend to both sides. They say, okay, I think this guy's getting a bit weak. Maybe we better make him lend him some more money. So how does this divide and conquer system actually break down? If one king got to rule the whole show, if he maybe was in charge of Europe, then he'd say, hey, why do I need these bankers anyway? Forget those treaties. But this is a bit of a dangerous prospect for the bankers. So does that give you another perspective on why they were always fighting these wars and nobody was actually completely winning? Well, I never heard anything about this when I was studying history and wars. They all talk about Protestants against the Catholics or these other differences. And yeah, maybe that was important. But what was also important that somebody was making money from all these wars. You know, nothing puts people into debt the way that war puts you into debt. Not only that you have to buy new weapons and so on, but people were doing things like knocking down castles and blowing up bridges. And yeah, that's a good way to make somebody poor, to make them need to borrow money. So they worked out, okay, they are getting extremely rich from this process of basically helping themselves to what the national treasury, because it's all legal. You know, the king agrees that he's going to pay 8% on this money that he borrowed. So in the 19th century, they have lots of money, and yeah, they probably had wild parties and built themselves big estates, but there's a limit, and they know that this money is some kind of a fiction. because they are in charge of it and they can just make this paper out of nothing. So what do they want? They're looking for power. How do they get power? Well, they already have quite a good influence over the national governments. So they are in a good position to say, okay, well, these corporations, you know, they had corporations, but they were originally very few in number. They were marginal, and you needed to maybe get a law passed to even start one up. That's a bit of a hassle. So what we see in the 19th century is that corporations become more and more dominant, and the legal systems are getting changed so that it gets easier and easier to create these corporations. And originally, you maybe start a corporation that does one thing, it builds a railway or a canal or something, and then after 10 years, 20 years, it's done, it's finished, it's dissolved. And there's strict limitations on what they can do. Well, this goes to the wall in the 19th century, especially in the US. You have this lovely Bill of Rights about what the person has legally empowered to do. And those same, because you get this idea that, okay, well, a corporation is legally should be a person. And the corporations say, okay, I've got a right to privacy. I've got a right to all these things that people used to have rights to. So they build up a large infrastructure that, I mean, we just think this is the way that life is. But it was an innovation at the time that there's large top-down hierarchies where you have to do what the boss says. And who gets to run these? Well, who gets to own them? Oh, the super rich. That's handy. So now you've got this, you've got the machinery is there for mass production. What do you need? You need a lot of people at the bottom level. People who say, yes, boss, of course. Well, in the land of independent farmers, like the US used to be, people went to the US because they didn't want to take orders. Why would they want to be in corporations? This is where mass compulsion schooling comes in. Now, maybe you think schooling is about helping the poor to become educated and to get free. I don't think so. Actually, it was a project of the rich industrialists. I mean, the first lesson that you learn in school is, shut up, I'm the teacher, you got to be here on time, and don't run around and do things you want to do. Do what I say. So economic literacy is a particular unfavorite of mine. You know, literacy is about, okay, you can learn to read books, you can go ahead, find out what you want to find. Economic literacy is completely different. Economic literacy says that you are economically literate if you know that people should be self-interested, and if you're not self-interested, then you're kind of irrational. So it's basically brainwashing you to think in a certain way, that specific way, that means that you do a cost-benefit analysis on everything. Now, that sounds, again, like common sense in a certain perspective, but if there's a group of people who have an unlimited amount of money because they control the money system, they're in a good position to manipulate the cost-benefit analysis. Here's another angle on economics. That if you learned economics, maybe you thought, okay, if you want to borrow money as an individual, then you get some money from the banks, do some business, pay it back with interest, because of course banks need interest, huh? They've got to make a profit. So that is the micro level. I'm encouraging you to look at it on the macro level. We, humanity, borrow money from banks, certain amount, we have to give it back with interest. Where does the interest come from? We are not allowed to make our own money. You know, there's all these laws about forgery and so on. And, oh, well, then I guess it's got to come from the banks, hasn't it? So we get it from the banks next year if they're feeling like they're kind to us. Thanks, boss. So basically, you're getting more and more in debt. The economics, the microeconomics says, if you're a good businessman, you can make some profit. Okay, great. I don't care who's good at business and who's not. It's not possible for everybody to pay back those loans to the bank. And the bank can control this. They have a little dial called the interest rate. And if they increase the interest rate, if they don't give new loans, more and more people will go under. So it's a divide and conquer mechanism against the people. Now, I'm claiming that this is tribute. This is the equivalent of, in the Viking days, the Vikings would come to your village and say, I want some gold, otherwise we're going to come back and we'll destroy your village. That was quite effective at getting gold. But it was also effective at annoying people. They didn't like it. Well, this is what we have now in the money system. But if you're economically literate, you know that that's the way that it's supposed to be. Because you've been trained to see it from a certain perspective. And okay, people are getting in more and more debt. What is this money system that has got people's loyalty? Originally, it was a personal gift from you to somebody else, a token of how much you appreciated them. And that became standardized in these larger groups. Then we have the metal discs. That was very large range. Then, okay, we gave up a bit about the metal. It becomes fiat money, paper money. This is becoming very, very anonymous. You know, if you run the show, you can say, okay, let's create another $700 billion bailout dollars, whatever, on the computer. Who knows? And then you get onto financial vehicles, derivatives, or credit default swaps, all kind of funky stuff like that. And there's a lot of war going on about that because the guys who run the show are saying, no, this is absolutely has to be the case. There's other people saying, look, we haven't got a house. We didn't do anything wrong. It's like, well, this is the system. And the assumption is always that it cannot be changed. Globalization is another case in point. It's presented like, well, this is kind of the way that the world is, that this has to be. And all these kind of boring, you're not told much about, well, I was not told much about this in school. These international bodies, they're supranational, really. I mean, who runs the IMF? Who's running the WTO? I don't know these things. Maybe I'm just terribly underinformed, but you don't hear about this very much. But this allows national governments to say, okay, well, we have to keep these kind of terms up. We have signed up to this. I would love to do these things that the people want, but there's a higher authority that is in no way democratically represented. And the logic is basically the same, that, okay, we have to run things by the market. And who actually set up the market? Oh, the money masters. Who are they? Oh, I don't know. I didn't learn about them on the television. Why not? Because, oh, they're the rich. They own the television. So that is you. For most people, you're getting fed by these corporations. They're giving you orders. They're giving you money. And you're working for them. And then there's the enforcers. What was the last time that European armies were used to fight other European armies? It was not that recently. We've seen things like the whole pepper spray incident, and they're basically there to keep you under control. And, of course, they're controlled by the politicians. Now, that is the limit of the picture as it's presented on the corporate media. In fact, of course, the politicians are highly responsive to the donations or the lobbying or whatever you call it, but the corporations also, we've seen it. Huge corporations like General Motors, they're going out of business because they don't get some money. Somebody else, AIG, whatever, they're getting all sorts of money. Who makes those decisions? Isn't that important? Well, human beings are making those decisions. They don't perhaps advertise the fact. They'd like you to think, well, that's an economic fact of life, but suggest, I didn't think it is. So I hope that you have clear that it's a means of extracting tribute, basically. I didn't talk about whether it's a safe store of value, but if they double the money supply, your $1,000 in the bank, that's still worth $1,000. But if all the prices have doubled, half your savings have gone. Who got that? Oh, well, who got the extra money that they made? Oh, maybe they didn't ask you about that. So it's a measure of how close you are to where the free money appears out of nowhere that they don't like to talk about. Certainly it's intimately connected to the euro. Who created the euro? That was a project of the Bilderberg Group. So if you don't know who the Bilderberg Group are, you might want to Google on it, because the euro's kind of important. But yeah, strange that we didn't hear much about it. My claim is this, that as people discover that the money system is actually not a fact of life, that it was thought up, that it has, okay, for a long time it's been running, but it serves the interests of a very few people. Most people are increasingly getting stolen, getting robbed by the system, that we have the ability to make up a new system. And that's what I've been doing for the last few years. What would I recommend that you do? Don't fight these guys. I mean, that's what they do. Just walk away from them as best that you can. Work out how to survive without using money. And there are people who do that, even in Germany. Where I live in Bangladesh, 3/4 of people feed themselves from their own labor. That's become quite easily to imagine that, okay, the money system collapses, whatever, the rice is still growing in the fields. You will not get a lot of warning from the collapse of the money system. And I'm going to have a workshop, BO4, that's just around the corner. And if there's any time, I would welcome your questions. Thank you.